every second that ticks by.
The future is running out. You wanted to see Tomorrowland. Here it comes.
This is The Hollywood Outsider, a weekly movie and TV podcast with a new episode every Tuesday. This is a special episode of our show where we are going to talk about the movie Tomorrowland. Don't leave just yet. Don't leave. Hold on. We will talk about the movie spoiler-free from the very beginning, so we're not going to get into spoilers for a little bit, and we will warn you, I promise you, before we ever talk about anything spoilerific. We kind of want to discuss the movie in the same format that we did our Mad Max Fury Road episode a few weeks back, if you heard that one, where we discuss what we liked about the movie, why you should see this movie, any problems we have with the movie, but primarily because we enjoyed it and we want to share that experience with you. If you're looking for the latest regular episode of The Hoe, it is still there, so go check it out. Go to thehollywoodoutsider.com, go to iTunes, Stitcher, you'll find all of our recent episodes, reviews, interviews. And please share those favorite episodes on whatever social media you choose to use. But first, let's just jump into the land of wonder. Justin is the only one of the regular hosts besides myself that has seen the film and is a fan of the movie, but unfortunately he was unable to make it tonight. Joining me from my Blacklist Exposed podcast that Troy and I do, Troy Heinrichs. What's up, Troy?
What? How's everybody doing in Holand?
What? That's how you started off, huh? What?
Use your imagination.
It sounded like a Disney rap of some sort. Now, Troy, you and I do a weekly podcast on The Blacklist, the TV show The Blacklist, and that's where we know each other from. But if you are a regular Hollywood Outsider listener, you will recognize his voice from the live show we did about a month ago now?
Yeah, something like that. About a month, yeah.
He joined me for that live in Vegas, and we had a lot of fun and did that. He is a huge fan of the movie, and I guess we should explain one of the reasons why we're doing this, because I wasn't going to do this reaction cast, as we're calling them, primarily because, you know, it's a movie that I really enjoyed, but I honestly thought it was going to be a monster hit. Then the box office came out, did $33 million over the 3 days, and then it did about $40 million over the four-day holiday weekend. So the total's at 42.6 as of recording. It'll grow from there.
And in Hollywood terms, that sounds like wah, wah.
Yeah, see, for Memorial Day opening, that wasn't that good. And unfortunately, the way that the internet is these days, that automatically means everybody's running around screaming, it's a bomb, it's this, it's that. And then you read reviews, or several of those have not been very favorable. And both Troy and I are very positive on the film. Justin was too, like I said. To me, you know, one of the advantages to having this podcast and having the audience we have is to be able to speak to them and say, look, here's everything you're not hearing about the movie. Here's where we think critics aren't getting it, or maybe the box office isn't reflecting the true nature of the film. And that's what we're here to talk about. We're here to tell you what this movie is and why we really enjoyed it and think it's worth babbling in your ear for a little bit. Like I said at the beginning, we want to have spoiler-free thoughts for the first at least 10-15 minutes, just to kind of give people the impression of what the movie is. So, spoiler-free, can you explain the plot?
That is a really good question, because as people have asked me this over the last 2 days, I've really been trying to figure out how do you explain this movie without giving the movie away. And the best I can tell you is that let's just say that it is the brightest minds in society coming up with an idea that if it worked would be some kind of utopian state in contradiction with what we've been seeing in the media lately with like Fahrenheit 451 and The Hunger Games and the Divergent series in this dystopian society, right? So it's the contradiction of dystopian versus utopian society, mm-hmm. and how what we do and the choices we make drive those outcomes. I think that's about as far as I can go without giving anything away.
And what I will add to that is the movie itself follows a young girl named Casey, who's played by Britt Robertson. You might have seen her. She was in a recent Nicholas Sparks movie. I don't know, The Longest Ride.
Did you see that? Yeah, she's in The Longest Ride. Mm-hmm. She plays Angie in Under the Dome. You've also seen her in Life Unexpected as Lux.
Oh, because you're on Under the Dome, so you've been following her for years.
Oh, yeah. She's from Charlotte, North Carolina. She's about 25 years old.
Okay, maybe a little too much.
No, I fell in love with her when she did Life Unexpected on the CW. She was really great in that role as the adoptive kid. She's really got a breakout career, and she's very humble about her career, which I thought is really great because she could be, you know, the next quote unquote big thing, up and coming, sexy young. And here she's playing this role in Tomorrowland where she's almost like a tomboy.
Yeah, that's true. It's a little departure from her. The Longest Ride was quite the departure from what I'd known her from previously. But well, she's a teen prodigy. She's got a NASA engineer dad. She's an extremely curious kid. She's trying very hard to make sure that her dad is not unemployed because they're kind of shutting NASA down. There's a random encounter with a mysterious pin that seems to transport her to a magical world. She doesn't really know what this world is. It's an odd occurrence that she wasn't expecting. She was never expecting this pin to fall into her possession. So then she sets off, because of circumstances, to find a mysterious genius inventor named Frank Walker, who's played by George Clooney. And she basically enlists his help to get to this magical place, essentially Tomorrowland. Now, that's all we're going to tell you in the spoiler-free portion. We will get into the actual movie here shortly. But for those people that have not seen the movie and they're debating whether or not they should see the movie, do you think the trailer has done justice to what this movie is about? Because some people have absolutely loved the fact that this marketing was specifically minimal. Right? You would agree it's minimal?
Very minimal.
Very minimal. And some people have hated it because it gave them no indication whatsoever of what the movie was. Now, without saying, you know, about anything specific about the movie, when you walked out, do you feel like you should have gotten a little bit more from the trailer, or did you get enough that it got you there without just the Disney brand
attached? I got enough from what I saw in the trailers. And a few things that I was able to glean from like the Diz boards and Disney Insider stuff, because this is a Disney fan service picture in every regard. So if you are a Disney fan, you absolutely will want to go see this. But from that perspective, the only thing I could compare it to was my experience when I went and saw Brave. Because when I saw the trailers for Brave, and this is a difference between marketing, because I actually got pegged to be on a after show Brave marketing analysis panel, or whatever you want to call those things, and survey groups. And going into the movie, all I had seen about Brave, and my assumption was that it was a female version of, say, Robin Hood.
Okay.
She's going to go through the thing. She's going to kill the bear, bring it home to her dad, and prove her worth. That is what I got out of Brave from the trailers.
Because as dads, all we want are dead bears at our door.
Exactly. And then if you watch the marketing in this marketing meeting afterwards, it was all the stupid jokes. It was the Scottish guy dancing with his butt flying in the wind and all the funny stuff that the kids would like that it would play on the Disney Channel, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I don't have Disney Channel. I didn't see those. If I would have saw those trailers, I never would have gone to the movie because I thought those were stupid.
Oh.
So because I saw this coming of age woman, Peter Pan, or not Peter Pan, but Robin Hood style, I was like, yeah, hell yeah, I'm going to go see this movie. And then when you find out what the hell the movie's about, you're like, wow, that's amazing. I did not see that coming, and I was on the edge of my seat the rest of the way. Same exact experience with Tomorrowland. I saw enough that I was intrigued. I saw that, ooh, this is like mysterious, and I have to find out why this is going on and what's happening. I did see a full-length trailer in the theaters, so I got a little bit more of the action sequence in that trailer. And even with that, it was still not enough to say this is what the movie's about. And I just went in, imagination open, dream big. This is going to be spectacular. And I was pleasantly surprised.
Exact same thing here. I am in the camp that I do believe minimal marketing helps a movie. I do understand people that are concerned, though, because I've talked to a lot of people that, you know, this kind of movie is right up their alley. Because I know them, so I know their tastes, I know what they like, and same thing on social media, I know certain people and exactly what their tastes are, and they're like, I'm really not into it, I really didn't see anything that got me excited about it. For me, it was my most anticipated movie of the summer, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that I'm a huge Brad Bird fan. I think he's a quality director. He's done films like The Incredibles, The Iron Giant, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. The guy is very talented, love his work. So that alone works for me, but I get that doesn't work for major America, right? I mean, the majority of America and the world, possibly at this point, aren't familiar with Brad Bird simply by name. So talking to them, I specifically got that vibe that they just weren't getting jazzed by the commercials. So I think for somebody like me that's extremely well obsessed with films and the people behind the scenes, et cetera, I think you don't need an excessive trailer to get excited. But I think for average Joe public film goer, I think they needed to give a little bit more. Because I do agree, going back, and now that I've seen the movie, I went back and watched all the trailers. Originally, I'd only watched the teaser. And it really, really doesn't give you a good scope of what this movie in particular is really about.
Yeah, not even so much what the movie's about. It doesn't even give you a sense of what the message is about that you're supposed to take away from the movie. I think is also doubly hard for people that are dropping $12 to $15 on this picture.
Absolutely. And what I want to say to that is, you know, as far as the film goes and spoiler-free reviews go, it is a beautifully shot film. The effects are magnificent. I think the pacing is consistently smooth. I really don't think there's any... There are a couple spots that I think lag a little bit, but the majority of the film I thought flows beautifully. I think some of the ideas and the ideals in the movie flow beautifully. And there's so much imagination throughout the movie of just little things. And once you see the movie, come back and you listen to the rest of the podcast, you'll know exactly what I mean. But there are so many things that just feel like early Spielberg to me, that feel like that kid in a candy store just having a field day, letting everything in his brain hit the screen, hit celluloid. And I think that is probably why I really wish more of this movie was evident to people so that they got as excited about it as I was when I was actually watching it. Because it is a fun, fun film. And you saw it with your family. I assume your family loved it?
I only saw it with the 10-year-old daughter because, like my wife, she's one of these... You have to tell me everything before I'm going to invest the money in it. Mm-hmm. And even myself, I wanted to go see it in IMAX. And I was like, let's go. And it was like $65 for the whole family. And I was kind of even then like, holy crap, that's a lot of money. And
that's a mortgage.
But I was like, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm like, this movie didn't even have to have a trailer. All I saw was Brad Bird, Damon Lindelof, Britt Robertson, Hugh Laurie. And the soundtrack is actually produced by Michael Giacchino, who also did stuff for Lost and Star Trek, mm-hmm. which I'm very, very fond of his work. I've been listening to the soundtrack for Tomorrowland on Spotify already all day. The music is just wonderful. And because of that, I was in before I saw one piece of actual film. And like you were saying, the film is gorgeous because I believe this is the first film that's actually been produced on the Dolby Vision standard, if memory serves correctly.
I did not know that. So that's great. Great to know.
It was beautiful. I mean, that's why I wanted to see it in IMAX, too. I was like, Dolby Vision, Michael Giacchino, and I was like, you got to see it in IMAX. I mean, especially for my 10-year-old, this would be their first IMAX experience. Mm-hmm. How awesome would that be to see IMAX jetpacks?
And as a family film, she liked it?
There were some parts that were a little, like, she covered her eyes and a little kind of jumped back in the seat and a little shocking and the, you know, explosions are, you know, loud and abrupt. So if you're not ready for it, it could be scary for someone probably 10 or under. Mm-hmm. But as she's going along, she absolutely loves the fact that this is a movie that has two very strong female kind of heroines. And how many movies have strong female leads that can do what this movie does?
Not many. A big part of why we're doing this episode of the podcast is because the movie is well done, we think. The fact that it's an original premise.
Aaron, for the record, is not a Damon Lindelof fan.
I am not. No, I am not a Lindelof fan. Lindelof is one of those writers, and he's one of the writers, if you don't know who Damon Lindelof is. He's also the writer on Lost. Prometheus, he was a writer on that. He's always been, for me, the guy that writes a movie and never seems to know how to land it.
Right. He has the, I'm enjoying writing so much that I don't know how to end the writing.
Exactly.
But even, but with that, though, with Lost, with Prometheus, with Star Trek, with Tomorrowland, I love that about him too, because these movies are supposed to make you think and supposed to make you wonder. I like that about Lindelof because I always go away like this 2 days later, still like, oh, why doesn't nobody like this movie? I don't get it.
This one, I'm absolutely on board with that. I really think that after it was over, I was so thrilled that there was so much optimism in a movie. Like you were talking about Hunger Games. I mean, it's a dire freaking movie. It's just everything about it is negative.
And it gets worse every movie.
Yeah, and it gets just darker and darker and darker. The only positive is that Jennifer Lawrence is in it, and we all know she's fantastic.
Yep, yep.
This is a movie that's just flowing with optimism. It's just bright colors. It's well lit. It's a family movie. It's meant to take your kids to. You can enjoy it with your kids as much as your kids, just like with any Pixar movie. And it's original, which was my original point that I got when you brought up Lindelof. I got off track. It's original. We complain every single week on The Hollywood Outsider and pretty much in real life. I'm sick of remakes, reboots, sequels. That's all we ever get. Blah, 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 blah. This is an original premise, and it isn't bad. But unfortunately, you have some critics that seem to not understand what the movie is actually trying to do. Instead, they have all these ideas of what they wanted. So they have kind of left some disparaging remarks, and it's taken away from what I thought was a thrilling experience that if you were a fan of early Spielberg, I really think you will enjoy it. And I think this is a good point to open it up. I think we've sold it. Disney, you got a free ad right there. In terms of Troy and I both really enjoy the film. Just real quick, if you could give it a score, you know, our rating scale on The Hollywood Outsider is of $10 the full price of admission. What would you give it? What would you give it, Troy?
I turned to my daughter. I'll give you the daughter's opinion first.
Okay.
I turned to her immediately and said, hey, my friend does this show, The Hollywood Outsider. If you had 10 bucks in your pocket right now and you were going to go outside and pay to watch this immediately following this movie, how much would you pay? She said 9.
Hmm.
And I was like, okay.
So a kid that has no concept of money yet.
Right, exactly. But she wanted a dollar left over for snacks, I guess is what it was.
She wouldn't get much. So what would dad pay?
Initially, the minute the movie was over, I said $8.50.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about it for a day or two, there are some struggles and some plot holes that I was kind of like, yeah, that could have been better. So I dropped it to an $8.
Okay.
So $8.
Okay, I gave it
which
a 7.
Which is more than I paid because I only paid $7.75 because I saw the matinee.
So you should actually go back and give him a quarter.
I should.
All right, we'll get on that.
I'll borrow it from my daughter's dollar that she has left over.
I gave it 7. You can read my review on the site, thehollywoodoutsider.com. There's a few points that I thought they were a little preachy. There's a few spots I thought were a little long, but overall, really enjoyable experience. And I think it's going to be one of those movies that will grow on me the more I watch it. Now, with that said, with our basic spoiler-free thoughts given, this is officially spoiler territory. So from this point forward, if you haven't seen the movie, I would pause it. If you don't care about spoilers, then you know, continue and ride the Space Mountain with us, I guess. Are you ready?
I am ready. Dun, 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 dun. I've been ready for like 2 days.
All right. So what are critics missing? What are critics missing? Because I've read some reviewers love it, some reviewers don't. And I will say this. Somebody pointed this out to me actually on Facebook, and I agree with this assessment. The positive people that I know that have seen the movie, people that think positive, they try to act positive, they're not the hipster complainer types. Every one of them that I know that has seen this movie has liked it. Not necessarily loved it, but liked it. Everybody I know that is kind of the one that growls and doesn't like stuff. And, you know, I'm not going to say hates on things because some people are just real, real, real picky. But the finicky film goers, those seem to be the ones, from my experience, that haven't liked it.
I think that's the exact thing that the critics and everybody that doesn't like it is missing. It's this point of dystopia versus utopia. It's the pessimist versus the optimist. It's that theme in the movie that I don't think people quite get, that no matter what you do, there's going to be people that are always going to try to bring the system down, but there's always those people that are always, what could we do to solve it? What could we do that's better? How can we make things improved and not fall into the Taylor Swift haters trap?
See, I agree with that because the whole time I'm watching the movie and then I went and read because I knew going in, well, it's not getting quite the Rotten Tomatoes score, you know, the assessment, the average of percentage of positive reviews I thought it would. I was concerned because it's my most anticipated movie. I'm like, man, this isn't going to be very good. And it was. And then I go and read reviews and it feels like from the critics that gave it a negative response, all I kept reading consistently was, it wasn't what I wanted. Well, the movie isn't supposed to be what you want. It's telling whatever story it's telling. And it seemed like they wanted fun and zippy effects in the actual Tomorrowland. They didn't want the story that we got, which I thought was a story that was trying to be a little deeper than what they actually wanted. You know, I think they just wanted a bunch of spectacle and no real plot.
Yeah, if you want zippy and fun, go watch Rocket Man.
Exactly.
Or Rocketeer.
Rocketeer, go watch Fast and Furious, go watch Furious 7 8 times.
Or write your own damn movie.
That would be my preference. If you want a different movie, go write it.
This movie, when you think about Walt Disney and what Walt Disney stands for and what he stood for when he was alive and what he tried to do in his creation of Epcot and the contributions he makes to the World's Fair, and it's the reason why the Carousel of Progress still exists inside the theme park today, it's really that mission of hope and what we could be as a human race. And if you're not on board with that vision and that concept, then you might just well be an automaton.
Do you think that's the majority of what they're missing? They want it to be something different.
I mean, I don't know what they were expecting from it. I mean, were they really expecting, people riding jetpacks and doing jetpack races? They could watch that in Phantom Menace, which is a Disney-owned property now. I mean, I just don't know what they're grasping at when they say, I wanted something different. This was, it had the special effects when she rides the monorail inside of Tomorrowland, when she's walking around, the flashes are in and out of Tomorrowland and the current reality are amazingly done and mm-hmm. just so seamless. There's a scene in there where she's riding in a car and she touches the pin and she's literally like floating, sitting in a sitting position across this wheat field mm-hmm. towards the city. I mean, that's just magical. I mean, Disney or not, this is what you expect a summer blockbuster to be. You want a summer blockbuster to wow you and take you to a place that you've never been before. And I'm like, that's cool. Okay, I'm in from that point forward.
It filled me up with optimism. Something I haven't had in a movie, you know, for honestly quite some time. It's been a while since I saw something that was really optimistic, that I felt like wasn't setting out to show you a horrific event that somebody just automatically fixes. You know, this is saying, yes, the world is headed for a bad end. And, you know, we tried to build this perfect world to get away from, you know, that bad end. And we're going to see if we can fix it. But now we're going to fill them with bad thoughts and make it really bad. But ultimately, the movie is totally about hope. It's about optimism. It's about believing in your fellow man. It's about a lot of things that I really think a lot of critics, anyway. I haven't gotten that from many audience members, but a lot of critics just seem to miss.
Completely. Well, and it's about science. It's about technology. It's about mathematics. It's everything STEM is trying to promote. And here we have two females in this movie who are giving females the idea that STEM is cool. Mm-hmm. And if you miss that as a critic, you're like heartless and just should lose your job. I mean, I'm there with my daughter. I'm like so proud that you have this aspiring woman who wants to go to the moon. So she wants to go into space so bad that she wants to basically sabotage the dismantling of a launch pad and risk going to federal prison over it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's cool. I mean, that shows you someone that just has a bright future that wants to just be more than she is. And what a positive message that sends for my daughter.
Absolutely. And Athena is a great role model, I would say, even though it's a robot. Is it a robot, android? I don't know what I always get those titles mixed up.
Autonomous something something, she says. But
there
yeah.
you go. That thing.
In your earthly tongue, it's called robot.
There you go. She's a robot with a bunch of skin all over her.
And she's 12. The actress that plays her, slipping my brain at the minute, but she's 12 in this movie. And she knocks it out of the park.
Raffi Cassidy.
Raffi Cassidy. Raffi Cassidy. Amazing job.
She is amazing. And one thing I wanted to mention before, because I know I'll forget later, there is a love story. There's an underlying love story that really sets up Frank Walker, George Clooney's character. And, you know, he's bitter. He's been living in this shell. He's been heartbroken, all because he was a young boy who fell in love with this robot and basically was cast out.
And well, he fell in love with the robot, not knowing it was a robot.
Yeah, not knowing it was a robot. And it seems like he found that out later. Obviously, I mean, you know, she's 12 the next time he sees her when he's in his 50s.
Right.
And I really think in lesser hands, this is a creepy, creepy storyline. Because it's very, very hard to present a film where a 50-something-year-old man can look at a 12-year-old robot slash girl with loving eyes, which he does have at the end when he's holding her in his arms. George Clooney very much has loving eyes. He has, I'm losing someone I love.
And I would say that that is the one moment where I was like, the movie worked, especially for Damon Lindelof, because I was like, there's closure. Damon Lindelof finally found closure on a story. This is great.
Well, I'm sure that was Brad Bird's end.
Either way, they worked together.
They partnered up, yeah. Because in a lesser director, I think that moment would never work. I think Bird shot it extraordinarily well because that was the moment I knew. I saw it coming, and I'm, as an avid moviegoer, I'm like, oh, don't blow this, don't blow this, because if this moment goes creepy, you just ruined the entire movie for me. Sincerely, as a dad and everything, that would be a moment that would ruin everything for me. And they played it beautifully. I absolutely bought that it was the child in him that still, you know, will always love her, that sort of thing. You know, it's long lost love. Even though she hasn't aged, for him, you know, it still burns in his soul. And the fact that he finally got closure, his closure with her, did his character a wonder of good. And they played it just beautifully. It could have been an awful scene. And because you had a good director, worked great.
I mean, and that's the one thing I think the critics miss is that they're looking at it because you're taking it at face value again. You're not thinking outside the box. You're not dreaming bigger, as the kind of mantras of the movie entail. And the scene, just you can see that it's not Frank, the 50-something-year-old cranky get-off-my-lawn guy looking at this 12-year-old robot. It's the 12-year-old Frank who's just like, man, this is why I wanted to come here in the first place. And thank you so much for this journey that I got to be on and that we finally depart on good terms. And it isn't because I hated you for all those 50 years that I didn't know where you were.
When I was cursing you and yeah. What worked for you? If throughout the movie, you know, when you walked out because you were high off it, your kid was high off it, what really worked for you? What sang to you?
It was just damn fun. I hate to curse.
No.
Is that a curse word?
I don't know. It depends on,
but people
know.
On Common Sense Media think damn and hell are curse words in this movie. And yes, there is a lot of damn and hell in this movie. So if you're one of those people that thinks damn and hell is a curse word, FYI, there's cursing.
It's a PG-rated movie, man.
I know.
I think it's ridiculous. Okay. Go watch Goonies. There's swearing in that too.
Oh, there's more than that in there.
Yeah.
No, it was just fun. I mean, that summer kickoff is Memorial Day weekend and summer blockbusters. And I go to a summer movie to sit back, enjoy it, be amazed, be thrilled. Everything about this was great, especially when they go to the toy store and you find out that there is actually a antagonist in the story, which are these robots.
Mm-hmm.
And man, the entire action with the robots, I thought was brilliant. It was so much fun.
You pointed out several things about the toy store. Why don't you illuminate those listening?
Oh my gosh. So in the toy store, this is like, so for the people that are like avid collectors, this is like the one place you would go is like a giant like antique store, but for like everything related to toys and movies. And in there, there's obviously a couple nods to Brad Bird, as Aaron mentioned, directed Iron Giant and The Incredibles. So you got some of that in the toy store.
I caught those. Those I caught.
But there's also an R2-D2, a giant Han Solo in carbonite.
I saw that one.
And a stormtrooper way in the back. And immediately when I saw Han Solo in carbonite, I was like, okay, someone's going to get trapped underneath it. So that's probably one of the, kind of telegraphed a little bit there, but it was still cool because if I didn't know that Disney owned Star Wars from the trailer before the movie, I definitely got that now. And it was everywhere in the toy store.
And a fun fact, did you know Brad Bird was actually the first one offered episode 7?
Oh, that's a fun fact. Yeah.
Yeah. He was offered it, turned it down to do this movie, actually.
I'm glad he did because I think this is better fit for his style and what he brings to the table because there's just so much. I mean, to this day, we're all saying, Incredibles 2, where are you? We have to go after the Underminer. Come on, Brad Bird.
That's his next one. That's his next movie. He's doing that next.
I sure hope so. I've been waiting forever.
Well, I think he had to agree to it to do this one. I don't know that for a fact, but it sure feels that way.
Oh, it was like a two movie deal.
I don't know that for a fact. It seems logical based on the way things rolled out.
But even Iron Giant had such a great positive message in it, and it's just so hard to see critics panning him so badly. Mm. It hurts.
Yeah, it burns. It burns.
It kills my inner child.
It burns the cockles of my heart. It does. What other stuff did you like? I love the jetpack. I thought it's one of those things where ever since The Rocketeer, I don't think any movie has really nailed that. Like the joy of what would happen if you slap a jetpack on your back and were able to fly around. And when Frank Walker, as a boy, puts that jetpack on his back for the first time and flies into Tomorrowland, and we see basically, you know, a really improved version of the Disney theme park ride. And he's flying, zipping around, da da da. That's everything I wanted right there. You know, that's everything in the trailer that I think some critics they wanted the whole movie to be that. I love that moment. I love that we didn't get an hour of it, because I don't know if you can keep up that momentum. And I wanted more of a story than just this kid ends up in Tomorrowland. I like this idea that how do we get back there and everything else. And that scene with the jetpack is everything that made me think this is going to be like a Spielbergian kind of movie.
Yeah, I mean, I said right away as I was watching Frank's childhood story portion of the film that this just feels like E.T. It feels like Goonies. It feels like something magical that you just had to experience that first time. And it just, you talk about it years later to the point where they're going to make Goonies 2, apparently.
That's never going to happen.
Oh, gosh, I hope
it does. They're like 60 years old now. Think how awkward that would be.
It's their kids. It's just like the vacation movie that they're going to make.
Yeah. Ooh, Chevy Chase just looks awful. Awful.
Trust these kids going back to Wally World to shoot more BB guns.
That's funny.
The jetpack scene was fantastic. And I think that was what's really kept me grounded in this film is the comedy was so well placed. It didn't need to be overly funny or overly stupid funny. It was just, there's this scene where he basically comes in and he's trying to basically win a contest at the Epcot Inventor's Invention at the World Fair for $50. Mm-hmm. And Hugh Laurie looks at him and says, it doesn't work. So then he's like flying around and he lands right in front of, we find out his Governor Nix later on, and basically just looks at him and says, works now. It's like, that's such a great line.
It was. I think people have gotten to the point where we're so hardened and every movie has snarky and sarcastic as its humor. They've forgotten that you can have like just lighter kinds of humor. You can have goofy humor and subtle and sweet humor. It is possible. You can have that movie still.
And I think the way that the final scene, it's not really the final scene, but as he's saying goodbye to Athena, that, correct me if I'm wrong, Athena, I believe is her name, correct?
That's her name,
Okay. As he's saying goodbye to Athena, he's just pissed off because robots don't have emotions, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's saying, you know, why did you never think I was funny? And she's like, the reason why I never thought you, I'm going to ruin it now.
The reason why I never thought, you were never funny.
I never laughed at your jokes, that's what it was. Whatever. He was pissed off that she would never laugh at his jokes, and then she turns to him and says, you know why I never laughed at your jokes, right? And he's like, no, why? And he's like, because you weren't that funny. And I was like, that's so great, because it doesn't necessarily show love in this creepy 50-12 ratio way. It shows that they're kids and that they're just full of fun. And because of that, this robot could potentially have, quote unquote, feelings because she's able to have humor.
Mm-hmm. Just beautifully done. And when I, at the beginning of this episode, I talked about, when we were talking about the spoiler-free portion, I said that this world had so much imagination, so many things were flying by that it was hard for me to keep up because there were so many things going on. I'm like, wow, that was so imaginative. That was so interesting. That was unique, et cetera, et cetera. I keep saying et cetera a lot. Apparently, I should get that trademarked. And what I mean by that was, as I watched the movie, it felt like every scene had something that caught my eye, you know, whether it was the jetpack or whether it was the coin and how beautifully they shot that flipping between worlds, or whether it was, you know, how she broke into how she used drones and whatnot to break into the actual NASA facility, how she was part of Tomorrowland and then not part of Tomorrowland, how once you got there, or once you got to Walker's house, there's all those little things in the background that you're like, wow, what is going on? How they use the Eiffel Tower as a launching pad? How they, you know, they used
and it. It wasn't just that it was the Eiffel Tower was a missile launching site.
Right, it's right? a missile For launching
the,
site.
There was history involved in why the Eiffel Tower was created. And I love that because that's exactly what Disney does when you go to like the Carousel of Progress or Spaceship Earth. You get a history lesson on top of the enjoyment. And the fact that that was tied into the movie just proves the point that this was such a Disney fan service in a lot of ways, but in a good way.
Just everywhere, just everything. I mean, the little touch of when she gets it, when Casey's at Walker's house, when she first gets there and the dog runs out at her and she notices, because she's a very perceptive kid she's really a woman, but she's playing a teenager and she's so perceptive that she realizes the dog doesn't have prints. So it's not, therefore not a real dog. Little things like that, that are just so damn creative. I just throughout the movie thought, how can you walk away and not be impressed in some way with this movie?
Yeah, and I'm a Dark Tower fan from Stephen King, and we've been waiting for a Dark Tower movie forever. So the minute I saw her get on the monorail, and the monorail is a floorless monorail,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that was in book three. And then the whole drawing of the three, which is book two, the whole portals on the beach, the magic doors that go to other realities, and seeing those actually happen in a movie just gave me so much hope, which is the whole point of the movie, was to give you hope, but gave me hope that a Dark Tower could be excellent because these special effects now exist.
Now, what did you think of the actors? As far as George Clooney, Britt Robertson, Hugh Laurie, what did you think about them? Did anybody blow you away? Do they impress you more than you thought? Or pretty much everybody was where you thought they would end up?
No, Athena and Casey, when they're interacting, I love their interactions together. I also love Casey's little brother. He was the kid who played the creepy automaton robot on Extant on CBS.
Oh, okay. That's who that was.
Yeah. But there's a scene where Athena comes to the house and she's got a box of Oreos. And it's like, hi, I'm selling Girl Scout cookies. And he's like, where's your uniform? Oh, it's at the cleaners. It's like, well, that's a box of Oreos. And she's like, shut up. I thought that was so great. I mean, just the kids in this movie act with such awesomeness. You know, I mean, Hugh Laurie, I mean, every time you see him, you think House every single time. And every time I see him, I just want more House. But he was such a great bad guy in this movie. And he's not even really a bad guy. He's just doing what he's told to do, I guess. So, I mean, you have to have a villain in the movie, I suppose. And maybe he's not quite the villain. Maybe the villain is ourselves.
Well, I don't know if he was doing what he was told to do so much as that he was doing what he thought was the best thing to do. I mean,
right. Given the fact that he had no other outcome, this is what had to be done.
Yeah, he's just trying to speed things along, basically.
Right.
And yeah. I did, since you brought up House, I wanted to point out when his leg gets crushed.
Oh my god! That's exactly what I thought.
I'm like, is this a prequel to House? Is this how House actually hurt his leg? Because that would be funny. It's not actually pain addiction. It wasn't something that happened like that. It was because he got crushed at Tomorrowland.
That's why.
Exactly. It all makes sense now. No, I agree with you. I was surprised. Not that he was an effective villain, because I think Hugh Laurie is a phenomenal actor. I love House. It's one of my favorite shows. And it was more that the movie didn't necessarily need a villain so much as it just offered somebody with a differing point of view. I guess from my perspective, Hugh Laurie's character, Nix, was more of the dystopian viewpoint, whereas Frank Walker, as the movie went on, and Casey especially, were the utopian viewpoint. So well, I saw it not so
Frank
much
is
as
only
a villain.
Utopian because Casey allows him to become utopian again. So it's
well,
like his
I said, as
redemption
the movie,
story.
Yeah, as the movie goes on, yeah. But Nix for me was like you were talking dystopian versus utopian. He's the dystopian viewpoint. He's the guy that wrote The Hunger Games. Whereas Casey is much more positive and optimistic that we can fix all of this. Stop ruining it for me. You know, and I like the opposing viewpoint. I don't necessarily think Nix was wrong. I just think he went about it the wrong way.
Right, because the real enemy in this movie is humanity's self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, Because we suck as a species.
We totally do.
That should just be the tagline on the poster. America, we suck.
Tomorrowland, you don't deserve it.
That would be great. That would sell it. I think they're there. That's how you sell it. That's how you sell it. What didn't work for you?
There's a couple parts where I was a little kind of, and one of those would have been at the beginning, the actual beginning. I thought the storytelling mechanism where, and it works because they go back to it at the end of the movie, but they start off with like this like speech that George Clooney is giving, and you hear this person off of camera, and you realize later that it's Casey, and they're like literally kind of, I guess, bickering back and forth, for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. about the best way to tell this story to a bunch of potential new recruits that are going to bring more people to Tomorrowland. Mm-hmm. And the way it, I don't know if it needed to be done that way personally. I would have rather just gone right into, the whole story with Frank and his childhood and that whole sequence by itself, and then do the, teleportation to 50 years later, or maybe even gone at least as far as him realizing that Athena was a robot, but not quite, because mm-hmm. then it would ruin the whole robot reveal for Casey, or not, because we would know, but she wouldn't know. And then jump into Casey's story, like do the, 50 years later, flash over the screen. And the banter between the two of them was like, I was a little worried at first.
Same here. I actually did not. I think that scene in particular doesn't work. Thankfully, it's over pretty quick, but it really rang kind of false to me. When the movie was over, it made sense, but I just don't think it works at the beginning of the movie.
And why did you need the countdown timer with incandescent bulbs? That's the one thing I was just scratching my head. Like, if you're not going to show it again in the rest of the movie, why are you going back to it?
I don't know. That was something we didn't need.
Just give me a digital clock countdown on the thing right next to the 100% sign.
One of the things I had said at the beginning was that I thought the movie was a little long in spots and a little preachy in that last act. I think the final act, when they're having exposition alley, where they're explaining everything, and I mean everything, and
you had the evil villains
the monologue. It was a little long, a little heavy, a little hefty, and I just don't think it needed to be gone into that much detail. That to me felt like, this is like, because Brad Bird and Damon Lindelof wrote this together. And that whole monologue, I'm like, this feels like Lindelof wrote this whole thing. Because it's too long, and it should have ended about 5 minutes ago. But hey, it is what it is. I don't think it necessarily ruined the movie in any way, shape, or form, but it definitely took me out of it for a little bit. Like, all right, you got to move this part along because now we're dragging.
Yeah, the other three parts that didn't work for me. Number one, the jetpack scene at the end, skipping mm-hmm. across the water, mm-hmm. little weird in the special effects department when all the other effects were super amazing. That last one was just kind of like, ooh, how did you miss the mark on the end?
Yeah, it did fizzle out a little bit.
Casey has a mom in this scene where she's like naming all the constellations off when she's like 4 or 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mom's never talked about again.
Yeah, I don't remember. I was thinking that too. I'm like, what happened to mom? Did she die? I assume she's dead.
And does that influence what kind of character Casey is? Is she this strong woman and belief and hope and all of this because she has to be that way for her dad because her dad's about to lose her job and her mom's dead or left the family or whatever? It just would have been nice to know what happened to mom. Two seconds. Just what happened to mom.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I said three. Oh, if I had to replace one person in the movie, it would be Clooney.
Whoa.
I have to say Clooney in this movie is the best Clooney I've seen in a while. He looked like he had fun with the movie. It looked like he enjoyed the movie. Like you could see he was really liking this role. But at the same time, because it's Clooney and there's so much outwardly stuff about Clooney, it takes away from Frank a little bit. I wish they would have had like a lesser known actor play Frank.
Okay. I guess I can make sense of that. I think they needed a name to get the movie going.
Oh, they absolutely did. Cause there's no other name in it except for Hugh.
Yeah. Especially with this budget. I mean, it's like a close to a $200 million movie.
I would have really liked to have seen maybe Tim Robbins play the role, only because Tim Robbins had such a great character when he portrayed the Bill Gates type person in Antitrust.
Mm-hmm.
And then plus because in this high school sequence, when they're like going through English class, talking about all these dystopian societies, and he holds up Fahrenheit 451. Tim Robbins is actually the narrator on Audible for Fahrenheit 451. So I thought that would be funny if he was Frank, and then he talk about the book. But that's just me.
Okay, so that's what I already told you what I would change. That's an interesting switch to change Clooney out. I love Clooney. I don't think Clooney can do much wrong, man.
He was fun to watch, but I mean, you picture him in like Perfect Storm, Rough and Gruff. You picture him in The Descendants. You know,
but see, I liked him loosening up a little bit, getting a little lighter, and not being stereotypical George Clooney. I mean, he seemed like he was having fun. You know, like the George Clooney of talk shows. You know,
yeah.
Which you don't see much of because he's usually doing these heavy roles or he's directing and he's got a very heavy heart. I like that. And I also, before I forget, I love that they use the old Cherokee parable, feeding the right wolf.
Feeding the white wolf, yeah.
Yeah, I'm...
The right wolf.
The right wolf. I'm a big fan of that parable. It's a very true parable. In fact, I agree with that 100%. You know, whatever wolf... in yourself you feed, that's the kind of person you're going to be.
And I think that's what the critics totally missed.
Absolutely. I think the movie is screaming, stop being so damn negative. Try to have a little bit more positivity and things will change on their own just from your state of mind.
Even if it's 1/1000th of a percent, it makes a difference.
Totally does. And one of the things that I love most about interjecting that optimism is that it's very reminiscent of early Disney. It's very comparable to how Walt Disney always envisioned his world of being. At least, you know, I don't know about behind the scenes, but to the public, that seemed to be the world he always wanted.
This
optimistic, like, fun, free to be a child world.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally felt like one of those ABC Sunday night world of Disney movies that mm-hmm. we had growing up.
Yeah, and they even have a little black hole in there. Did you see that?
Yeah,
that was
I did.
A nice little throwback. Like that a lot. Now, what about any little facts or tidbits as we close this up that you noticed in the movie?
Let's start out with the origins of sci-fi itself. I think that's something very prevalent in this film, being Tomorrowland in the future. The couple in the film that actually owns the Memorabilia Emporium, as I called it, the toy store, mm-hmm. are named Hugo and Ursula Gernsback. And using the name Hugo Gernsback is actually homage to the publisher of the magazine Amazing Stories.
Oh, very
nice. Hugo Gernsback, which launched in 1926 and basically considered the father of sci-fi, creating sci-fi as it is.
Very nice. Very nice. I noticed that the belt Casey wears is the same one that Woody wears in Toy Story.
Totally.
Yeah. I caught that one, only because I saw Toy Story about 6,000 times.
Still going. Still counting.
Oh, you're still on there, right?
The movie was actually going to be called 1952 originally, and then they decided to change it to obviously help promote the parks and make more connection because writer-director Brad Bird and Damon Lindelof actually found the inspiration for Tomorrowland from the contents of a box that was labeled 1952, supposedly discovered by accident in the Disney Studios archive. The box contained models and blueprints, photographs, and letters related to the creation of Tomorrowland and the contribution to the 1964 World's Fair, which is where we see Frank in the opening part of the movie.
Oh, wow, that's really cool. You want to hear one that this one is on IMDb. I didn't pick up on it. I just stole this one. It says, in the background of the World's Fair, the White Rabbit from Alice in the Wonderland and the Fox from Pinocchio are walking together. The White Rabbit traditionally symbolizes going as far forward as you can, even down mysterious holes for the sake of an adventure. The Fox symbolizes being tricked at the idea of something promising and ending up in a bad place because of it. Both are themes in the movie. I thought that was very perceptive of someone.
At least somebody saw it.
Yeah.
Like critics.
Somebody, yeah. Oh, no. Sure. They sure didn't. Well, some did. It's funny if you read.
Some did.
If you read.
Not like, all critics.
Some critics got it. Some didn't.
Many didn't.
Did you see Space Mountain? I saw Space Mountain in it.
Like 100 times.
Yeah. It's all over the place.
Let me tell you, I love what Disney is doing now with the whole like digital concept. Like every movie now, when they do their standard castle opening and the Tinkerbell goes over with the rainbow wishes or whatever you want to call it. I'll probably get lambasted now by Disney fans for calling it a rainbow.
I doubt it.
But that whole sequence, the whole thing was done in futuristic style. Flying over the river, the train became a monorail, the castle was Tomorrowland instead of the castle, but in the shape of the castle. Just, I love how they keep changing the openings for these Disney movies to be whatever the movie's about.
Oh, absolutely. That was a beautiful shot. Right. Yeah, that was a beautiful shot. Beautiful shot. The Ayn Rand. Yep. Let's talk about Ayn Rand. There's been a few people that compared the movie to her views from her books, specifically Objectivism. What do you say to that? I didn't see it. I read them, but it was a long time ago. So what do you say to that?
The whole concept of her stuff, I believe, boils down into three concepts. And it's been a long time since philosophy class. I mean, I'm like 20 years out of college.
And she wrote Atlas Shrugged and some other books.
Yeah, but her basic theory on this objectionist concept is that there's kind of like three axioms. There's existence, consciousness, and identity. And if you think about it, the way she explains it is like existence is just being, right? Mm-hmm. I am, therefore I am. And then consciousness means that I think, therefore I am. I'm aware that I exist. And then the acts that the entity performs and the way in which those acts are carried out give an existence its identity, whether that existence is a person or space-time, what have you. But there's acts that happen which give identity to an existence. And as I thought about those three things, I was really kind of like, oh, okay. So here we have on one side humans, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they exist and they're trying to think better, even though they're being told not to think better by this machine in the movie. But there's some people who want to think better, and the way they act gives them their identity. They're either, you know, utopian in thought or they're dystopian in thought.
Because of the bad mojo machine.
Because of the bad mojo machine.
Mm-hmm.
But then you take it the other side and you have these robots who are basically literally automatons doing what Governor Nix tells them to do. Go kill anybody that wants to come to Tomorrowland, period.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have Athena, right? She's actually aware that she exists. So she has consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And the way she carries out her acts and her job as being a recruiter, even though it's technically programming, she carries it on a way with a sense of hope herself, I think, even though she's computing these, like, we'll call it Metachlorian scores or whatever the flesh Kincaid scale that she brought up in the movie. I don't remember exactly what it was.
Metachlorians, oh Lord. Oh boy.
But then she, obviously Casey scored higher than Frank, which pisses Frank off, which is another comic thing in the movie that I liked.
Mm-hmm.
But she has this sense of identity, consciousness, and existence. So is Athena alive to the point where you can have that ending scene be so powerful? I shed a tear. I was sobbing a little bit. I'll admit it. I'm a weak man sitting next to my 10-year-old daughter.
All right, I got misty-eyed, man. I got misty-eyed.
And I just think that that's amazing that you have this contradiction, right? I mean, not to take it to a biblical sense, but I mean, you have the whole doubting Thomas, Jesus Christ resurrection after the fact. And it's this total thing of, you know, you believe because you see. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. And it was the perfect mantra I could think of for describing this movie.
Okay, so do you believe that there is some validity to the Rand debate?
I think so. I mean, I can see the concept of the objectiveness, objectionist concept being portrayed in the film based mm-hmm. on these three axioms. But beyond that, I mean, you could go deeper, and I'm sure have some philosophical discussion over coffee and scones and whatever you want to do. Be a hipster. But, you know, at the same time, I think that there is something you should take away that just as humans are supposed to be doing better, this robot also wanted to do better.
I like that very much so. So,
and that's why I love it.
Yeah, I love it because it's hopeful, it's fun, it's zippy, it's entertaining, and it has a story, and I actually was interested in the story. Could it have been a little tighter? Sure, absolutely. It wasn't my favorite. I enjoyed Mad Max Fury Road a little bit better just because it's a different kind of movie.
Yeah, I mean, Mad Max Fury Road, I didn't see it, but I saw enough and heard enough about it that just the concept of them saying the emotions that are portrayed in that film with just visuals and music with no dialogue,
mm-hmm.
I mean, tells you that it's a great movie, because if you can show in picture's worth a thousand words, right?
Absolutely.
If you can convey that. And that's exactly what the jetpack scene did. No dialogue, just this beautiful openness of opportunity in front of you. And if you don't get that from watching that scene, you're artless, like Regina on Once Upon a Time ripped out your heart or something.
Well, absolutely. Because the whole movie, the whole mantra of the movie ends up being, this is a world for dreamers. You know, don't let the dreamer in you die. If you're a dreamer, embrace it, engage it, etc. There's etc. again. I'm going to start having to pay a quarter every time I say it. And I think that when the movie's over, I walked out of there thinking, man, I wish I could be that dreamer that I am, that is in, you know, it spoke to me as a person, as a creative person, as a person who likes to think outside the box and do different things and try to create in some way. I mean, this podcast is a creation of some form, and it really spoke to me. And I think if you're a dreamer and you haven't seen it yet, this is the kind of movie that I think will speak to you. I think if you're somebody that just doesn't care about that kind of stuff and you just want to go and have fun, I don't know if you're going to enjoy the movie as much. I think it's definitely for people with that wide-eyed optimism and that dreamer culture, and that's who the movie's made for.
Yeah, if you're a curmudgeon and you want people to get off your lawn, when they get off your lawn, go to the Redbox, get this for $1 because you're cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope and pray that as you watch the movie in your Barca Lounger, that you're moved with that dollar purchase.
Absolutely. Maybe you'll go buy it then and then give Disney more money because they need it. They're hurting. Now, should people see it? Bottom line, should they see it? If they haven't seen it, I assume if you're still listening, you probably have seen it. But some people are just like, I don't plan on seeing it. So let me listen to the rest of this podcast, see if it's worth it. So should they see it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whether or not you believe in giving Disney your money or not and supporting the theater and doing it before you die, you should see this movie. Absolutely.
You liked it that much. You're a huge fan.
Well, I looked at it this way. I wanted to go see it in IMAX. And yeah, $65 is a little crazy when I'm probably going to buy it on iTunes anyway and give Disney my third child.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually do want to go back and see it in IMAX now because I just want to see those scenes, the flying in the jetpack, the monorail, just to see those in IMAX and just feel the sound and the music from Michael. I'm just going to have to take off of work early on Friday.
It's a good plan, man. It's a good plan.
Plus, then it helps out get that total up higher because it's $15 instead of $7.
I want this movie to be a success. Not so much because I want a sequel, which we're going to get to that question in a second, but more so because I love when we get an original premise that works. And I feel
maybe that's
like,
the issue. Maybe people were comparing. I saw a comparison to Inception. And yes, Inception was amazing. Every time I have a dream at night, I think about that movie. Because
mm-hmm.
I feel like, am I alive? Am I awake? Am I whatever?
Is the top still spinning?
Is the top still spinning? Right. And even then, that top still spinning at the end gives you a sense of doubt and hopelessness. And mm-hmm. this doesn't give you that at the end. It gives you hope and prosperity and everything Star Trek was supposed to be when Gene Roddenberry did it, which is funny because they actually have Star Trek doors at the toy shop when he comes out for his grand opening.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Well, I definitely think people should see it too. I definitely think it is a movie that, outside of the fact that I just want it to be successful for originality's sake, I like the movie enough that I would definitely recommend it. I've been recommending it like crazy. I just hope we, you know, you and I, podcast, whatever, can make people actually want to see it. Because for whatever reason, I haven't seen the excitement to see it that I would hope to have seen.
So here, let's put the challenge out to all of you that are still listening at this point. If you haven't seen it and you're now going to go see it because of this podcast, let us know feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com. We'd love to know if this review has basically changed your mind. Go spend some money.
Absolutely. Now, do you want a sequel?
I'd love to go back to the world, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out what the antagonist would be in a sequel. I still have to think about it some more.
I don't want one.
I could spend all day in Tomorrowland. It's just amazing. The scenery, the sets, and 10 different cities they filmed this thing in. That's crazy in Hollywood terms.
I think if you went back, you would have to spend the whole movie there, because this movie has spent most of its time getting there. And I feel like then, once you get to that point, then it becomes a cheat to go back to Earth and spend a whole bunch of time on Earth. You know what I mean?
Oh, so. Absolutely. Yeah, because a lot of this movie is spent in regular Earth and not in Tomorrowland, which, FYI, is not another planet. It's just another dimension or plane of existence. I don't think we've covered that yet. So it is Earth, just in a different time or different space.
Right.
So, yeah, if you did a sequel, would it be future people coming to Tomorrowland because the future is dying again, which is really the same movie? Mm-hmm. Or somebody like Governor Nix's offspring or something is in the future? I don't know.
More robots are on the loose with the fantastically creepy smiles.
I love the robots. They just, I thought the robots would have been a different, and maybe that's what it is. Maybe there's a rogue robot, or maybe Athena comes back as a reprogrammed monster. I don't know.
I don't think you can pull off that love story twice. I'll tell you right now. I don't think it works twice. I don't want a sequel simply for the fact that I believe that there are some movies that should be just one movie.
Yes.
And I think this movie ends on a perfect note. I don't know how you come back to it. I really don't. I think, you know, it ends on such an upbeat, optimistic, we're going to fix the world now. We figured it out. Let's all rally together. Frank Walker saved. Casey's found her place. Casey's family's with her. I see no reason to revisit.
I know how they can revisit it.
How's that?
So they already have Toy Story 4 in the works. So Toy okay. Story 5, the toys are still alive all those years into the future. And then we're in Tomorrowland at the next daycare.
You're a dork. I don't want to see that movie. I don't want to see that movie. Please, please.
You
don't.
Totally would go see it just because it's Toy Story.
I don't want to see that movie. I hope this movie does very well, by the way. I really hope financially. I hope you guys are motivated. And like Troy said, if you're motivated to see it because of this podcast, please share with us what you thought. We'd love to hear your thoughts, and we'll definitely talk about them on the air. That's feedback at thehollywoodoutsider.com. Troy, any parting thoughts on Tomorrowland as we wrap things up?
Do not wait till tomorrow to see Tomorrowland. See it today, right now.
Did you spend all day writing that?
Yeah.
Good job.
I wrote it immediately after the movie, right on Facebook. You can go check it out.
Great job. Where can people find you in particular?
You could find me on Twitter at Troy Heinritz. That's Heinz Ketchup Ritz Crackers, no Z in the middle. And unfortunately, because the Blacklist Exposed is done for the season, you will have to find me trapped in Chester's Mill under the dome this summer, third week in June, I believe it is, moves to Thursday nights. That's at underthedomeradio.com.
Are you excited about that one?
I've seen some trailers that I'm just like scratching my head going, it's either going to be super awesome compared to season two, or we're really going to go down the giant suck hole as Nori explained in season two.
I hope for your sake that show just keeps being crazy, honestly, because it makes for a fun podcast.
It totally makes for a fun podcast.
You can, once again, that's Under the Dome Radio. You can find, and the Blacklist Exposed, if you're a Blacklist fan, you can always find us at goldenspiralmedia.com/theblacklist. That's where that show is. As well as The Hollywood Outsider, you know where that is. That's thehollywoodoutsider.com. That's thehollywoodoutsider.com. We're available on Twitter at @H_Outsider, facebook.com/thehollywoodoutsider. Email, like we said just a few minutes ago, feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com. That's going to do it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed the show. Troy, thanks for coming by. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. Thanks for putting this together. I love Reaction Cast. I hope we do more.
Yeah, absolutely. Plan on doing it. I don't want to get too crazy with it. Just for if it's something that really gets us excited or is really horrible, or we just want to spread the word like with Tomorrowland, then we'll probably do them. But you know, we're gonna be easy about it. Some people have said, why don't you do them for all the new releases? I'm like, that's a lot of time, man. It's a lot of time.
And unlike Aaron, some of us actually have other obligations financially, and we can't go every weekend.
That's get a movie pass. I can't recommend that enough. Movie pass. $30 a month. I see all the movies I want. Ha, ha, ha. All right, guys. Remember, the next time you go to a theater to see Tomorrowland, buy popcorn.